Welcome to Hot Grease. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. This Heritage Radio Network program is brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. The Edwards family has joined Heritage Foods USA and Newman Berkshire Farm to develop an all-natural product line featuring Serrano hams, Berkshire smoked slice and slab bacon, and Berkshire smoked sausage links. These new products are produced exclusively from purebred six-spotted Berkshire pigs raised completely outdoors on independent family farms. For more information about Edwards & Son, visit edwardssvaham.com. Every week on Hot Grease, we bring sustainability, local foods, and other forward-thinking schools of culinary thought to the minds and kitchens of everyday folks. Our conversations cover the entire spectrum of food enthusiasts, from renowned culinary masters to moms on a budget. Today, we'll be talking a New York City locavore and the Hot Five with April Gargiulo. Two things are making me happy today. The gorgeous spring weather in the Big Apple and the lovely Leda Meredith. In the studio, Leda is the author of Botany, Ballet, and Dinner, and her latest book is titled The Locavore Handbook, The Busy Person's Guide to Eating Local on a Budget. Welcome, Miss Meredith, to Hot Grease.
Pleasure to be here.
I want to talk about something very special in your book, or something that we often, or the last few months, have covered here on Hot Grease, and that is Haiti. The first chapter of your book is titled, How Can Eating Save the World? And you give a very specific example of Haiti. Please share with our listeners.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people nowadays are aware of the environmental aspects of why eating local or organic matters, but they might not realize the cultural, economic aspects. And Haiti, there's a situation where our industrial agriculture system directly impacted and added to the poverty there. Haiti was actually producing enough of its own rice a few decades ago that they were exporting it. They could feed themselves and export it. And then they signed a trade agreement with us in the U.S. that they had to allow U.S. rice farmers to compete. Now, the problem is we're subsidized. Our rice farmers are subsidized, and the Haitian farmers weren't. So there was no way they could compete with the prices of subsidized U.S. rice. So they stopped growing it. They just stopped growing it. And then you started getting the food shortages and disasters like the recent earthquake. And it just, you know, escalates the problem because they're in this deep poverty when they could be producing their own rice and their own food. But we basically undercut them on the prices because of our subsidy policies.
Later. So your journey to eating local starts at your first book. You talk about that a little bit, but then you definitely go more in depth in the Locavore's Handbook. Please tell me about your journey, and what just did you wake up one day and say, oh, my gosh, I want to eat no further than 25 miles away from my house?
Yeah. I haven't cut it as close as 25 miles.
I mean, 250, my bad. Okay.
My garden.
Well, you could do 25.
I could do my garden.
I
come from a family of great cooks and gardeners and foragers and food appreciators. So that was part of my background. My great-grandmother used to actually take me foraging for wild plants in the park in San Francisco. And now that's a subject that I teach at the New York Botanical Garden and the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, and for Green Edge, New York also. But the locavore, the strict 250-mile thing, happened because I got, inspired by reading about other people who'd done it. I read Barbara Kingsolver's Animal Vegetable Miracle, et cetera, all those great locavore books that are out there. But I also got frustrated because they all lived in warmer climates than I do with a longer agricultural season, or they had a lot more money or more space or more time. And I thought, okay, is this even possible in a one-bedroom New York City apartment with a New York winter on a budget?
Right.
So I set out to find out if it was.
Yeah, you have a very interesting section in the book, the first few chapters, called Going Hardcore. And you talk about rendering fat, and it definitely brought me back to my childhood, because my mother, my great aunt, I mean, all of the women in my family that cooked, they did that. They saved bacon drippings or whatever drippings. So when I read that, I smiled. You didn't like that at first, did you?
I didn't know what to do with it. I wasn't used to cooking with it. Mm-hmm. But I thought, A, there aren't that many vegetable oils here. The only ones I know about are from Stony Brook Oils, and they're more flavoring oils, mm-hmm. not cooking oils. So if I wanted to fry up an onion, I needed some...
Don't they have a store in Brooklyn?
Yeah. They're at Blue Rib, I think Blue Apron.
Okay, that's what I thought.
But those are like, they're beautiful, but they're strong. They're like a toasted sesame oil. They're not something you would cook with. So, you know, apologies to the vegans listening, but if I wanted to fry up an onion, it was going to be butter or animal fat. That was basically the choice. So I did start saving the bacon drippings like you're talking about and everything, but, you know, I was a little gun-shy to use them at first.
Yeah, they're really good. They add tons of flavor and save money, because we all know buying oils and stuff, it can get really expensive. And that goes to my next question about the cost factor in eating in local. You give tons of great tips. One of my favorites definitely is bartering with food. I've been doing that a lot lately. I've gone on a 3-week cooking spree. So I've cooked almost every day for the past 3 weeks. And I actually had some work that I needed some help on, and I bartered with a friend on like 6 meals. And when I saw that in the book, I'm like, God, she's good.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. Barter is definitely bartering time, bartering food. I just set up a deal actually to trade. Well, in June when they're ready, I've got red currants growing in my garden.
Ooh.
And I'm swapping a pint of those for a pint of local honey.
Could it be our favorite friend, Meg, the beekeeper?
It could, BK Homesteader. And I swap my time at my CSA, at my community supported agriculture. And I volunteer as a core member. And in exchange for that, I get most of my produce free from June to November. So talk about keeping it cheap. Free
so
is good.
So you swap your time from your garden at your... You said time, not... You mean time, like physical time. Physical. Not the herb. Okay, so...
No, thinking, not the time from the garden.
I'm like, wow.
That would be a nice deal.
So I was thinking, I was like, wow, is she giving all her time to the...
No, time like T-I-M-E. Yeah.
Gotcha. Another thing, you have really great stories. And what let me say this, I have to give you, I told you this before the show, but what I like about, I have about 3 or 4 books about becoming a locavore and all these tips. But what's very unique about your book is that you drill down to being a locavore in New York City. And I think for all of our listeners that are here in New York, this is definitely, in my opinion, the best book if you are looking for very specific things about New York City. And one of the great things you have, and that I'm always getting this question from friends that are trying to make the transition, you have a great chart and several paragraphs about eating with the season, particularly seasonal seafood.
Yeah, most people don't think about fruits and vegetables being seasonal, but fish migrate just like birds do. So part of what's in season with seafood is what happens to be swimming by our coast that the fishermen can get. Right now, skate is by far one of my favorite fish. And that's going to go out of season this summer, and then it'll be fluke. And those are two of my favorites, skate and fluke, because they're also really cheap and delicious flavor. I became aware of that when, you know, totally ignorant, I went up one day and said, hi, when are you going to get fluke back in? And the fishmonger looked at me like I was out of my mind and said, well, in the summer. And I thought, oh, right, that's seasonal too.
And I mean, you bring up a good point in the book too, and which I always forget about, if you're going and if you're shopping at green markets, particularly here in New York City, you need to get there early if you want to get the seafood.
Yeah. that they sell out fast, and it's one of the longest lines at the Green Market.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you need to be there when the, you know, 6 o'clock when they pull the trucks up.
Yeah.
To get seafood. So we're going to take a short musical break, and we're going to come back more with Leda Meredith talking all things local and the Local War Handbook.
Cut your wife and daughter like a meat cleaver. We be the Dungeon family. Niggas up under the step from ATL do overstand me. D-L is a clique I represent. Puffin' purple, poppin' poppa, spittin' straight pimp shit.
Conversation without compensation, we senseless. Not to mention that your girl, you're persistent in. Nothing physical happen, but give me 6 minutes. When you're off, somebody gon' get in it. Say no names, wear my hair longer than your first strain. Your girl wish she was drafted for the Georgia drill team. But ain't gon' say no more, you need to catch somebody else. I'm about to hit the dope, I'm out.
6 minutes, 6 minutes, 6 minutes, don't you family your home. 6 minutes, 6 minutes.
My home gon' be a palace, laid out like a salad, keep a nigga from malice. I'm moving things through the south. A dog like me need a pussy cat round the house with a rope on. Ain't nothing like me and you, baby, with no clothes on. I'm tired of running the streets all night, and a girlfriend ain't gon' stay down with you like a wife. I hate it all, you girls get to my.
Welcome back to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Check our program schedule and show archives out on heritageradionetwork.com. We're chatting with Leda Meredith. She's an instructor at New York Botanical Gardens and Brooklyn Botanic Gardens and beyond. So you mentioned in the first segment about your classes that you teach. I think most of them are all about edible and medicinal plants. And I keep seeing emails and postings everywhere about foraging in New York City. Do tell about foraging.
There are wild edible plants, delicious wild edible plants, all over the city. And, you know, talking about eating local on a budget, this is free food we're talking about. And I teach a lot of foraging classes. I've got a few coming up. And you know, it's just, there was one moment where I saw a homeless guy actually in the park holding out his cup for money and saying he was starving, and there were no fewer than 20 edible plants around him. And I thought, okay, this is stuff people need to learn. This is, you know, beyond gourmet ingredients, which it is, but it's also just survival know-how.
And you mentioned before, you said your grandparents. Did you say your grandmother?
My great-grandmother was from Greece.
Okay.
And there, everybody, comes spring, it's just what you do. You go out in the hills and you pick wild dandelion greens and stuff. So she used to take me to the park. That's how I started.
And it's so funny because when I hear the term now and I hear you talking about it, my great-aunt, she was almost like a grandmother to me. She lived to be almost 90, almost 100 years old. She used to pull this plant. It's called, I guess, poke.
Pokeweed, yeah, one of my favorites.
Yeah, and she would put them in greens and cook them green. So what kind of things do, is that something we can find here in New
Absolutely.
York?
Absolutely, there's poke all over the city.
Wow.
Yeah, and some of the things that you can buy now, you know, you can go to the farmer's markets and buy dandelion greens or buy purslane. Well, those are growing wild everywhere. So, you know, people are spending money for them, but they're available.
So beyond the poke, what... How would I cook? I know the poke you could basically just saute with garlic. Just
you have
like
to boil the poke first.
Okay.
Most of the right now we're in green season. It's too early for fruit, so sauteed with a little garlic. Pull out if you do meat, pull out those bacon drippings. Mm-hmm. Are really good with any of the greens, and maybe a little splash of vinegar.
Wow, food preservation. I'm actually going to a class tonight. Last year, I must admit, I did not do any. I didn't can anything. I didn't do anything. I like to buy stuff from people or swap. We were just recently at a food swap together.
Right.
And I picked up some jalapenos. And we had tons of stuff that people had preserved from the spring and summer. But talk a little bit about food preservation. And do you see, have you seen over the years this trend growing? Is it a trend or is it here to stay?
I hope it's here to stay. It's definitely growing. I'm teaching some food preservation classes this summer, and the, you know, attendance has swelled. But if you want to eat local, and I don't expect most people to go as extreme as I did and do a 250-mile diet, but even if they want to include a little bit more local foods, the food preservation makes the winter interesting. It's not just about stocking up for the winter. It's about varying your diet in the winter. So it's, you know, being able to open a jar of tomatoes in January and not have to, you know, get the ones from California.
So what are your suggestions when I get my CSA and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm getting,
what do I
have
do with
a
it?
Half share. And I'm like, this is still too much stuff. Do I need to start just immediately start cooking half and then doing preservation stuff with the other half?
That's about what I do. That's about what I do. And then come winter, you've got all that food, you know, just waiting for you. So even some simple things, it doesn't have to be. I think people get scared away by the idea of canning. But even if you don't get into that, blanching and freezing foods is really easy. You have too many greens, you can do that with them. You know, you can preserve in oil, you can dry herbs and things. There's some very simple ways to get into it.
What about the salting and the lacto fermentation? I don't know a lot. We had someone on the show, one of my earlier shows, talking about lacto fermentation. But just some basic things that people should know about those two things.
That's how traditional sauerkraut and dill pickles are made. And there's no, people think because they taste sour that there's vinegar in there. And actually, the traditional recipe, it's just made with salt. And the salt prevents harmful bacteria. And then the bacteria start changing and you start getting the lactobacillus, they're called, which is what gives it that tangy flavor that the sauerkraut and stuff has. You can do it with cucumbers. You can do it even with Swiss chard stems.
Oh, really?
You can do it with that. If you really want to go whole hog on the lacto fermentation, the guy who wrote the foreword for my new book, Sander Elix Katz, he is the king of fermentation. And check out his website.
He's the author of Wild Fermentation and the Revolution Will Not Be Microwave.
Yeah, he's terrific.
Oh, okay. Another question that I have is about the word locavore. And when you tell people you're a locavore, what they expect, and what, if you look into a locavore's bag, what should a locavore have? That's like three questions.
Yeah, okay. I'll start out with the word. First of all, you know, I was asked, I did an interview a couple weeks ago, and they kept asking me, did I think the locavore movement was a fad? And I said, do you mean locavore movement or local food movement? Because they're two different things.
True.
And locavore means specifically somebody who sets a radius from where they are, and they're going to get all their food from within that, 100 miles, 250 miles, whatever. Local food movement might mean some of your food's local, some's not, but you haven't set a number on it. You haven't set that specific radius on it. So that's sort of the locavore. So locavore is extreme. Locavore is the extreme local food movement.
Yeah, and some people, they get, hung up on the titles. I personally, when I'm in certain circles, I will say that. Oh, I'm a locavore, but I didn't realize I needed to define it. I guess it means so many different things.
It's flexible right now. I mean, it was actually the American Oxford Dictionary's 2006 Word of the Year, which I think is kind of funny because I don't think it existed much before 2006,
right,
actually. But, people do somewhat make up their own meanings for it. It means you try to eat local.
There you go.
What it means.
So you have a very interesting story, very funny story, about what's in a locavore's bag. So if I look at my bag now, I don't know. I have books. I always have like two or three books. I have books in there, and that's, I have some raw cashews. So maybe that's a good
snack
thing.
Snack material.
Yes. And you actually had that on the list, or maybe not. Maybe that was a few pages before. But what, tell us the story and tell our listeners, if you are a locavore and you're trying to be more conscious, what are some of the things that you need to have in your everyday bag?
Yeah, it's really three things. One is you need bags in your bag. You need some plastic bags or little fold-up cloth bags is what I have today, so that if you happen to come across a green market and you remember, I'm out of apples or something, you're not picking up those plastic bags. That's just a little eco-friendly tip. Two, you need something to write on, or your iPhone is what I use these days to type into, so that when you find something fabulous, you can jot down like amazing cheese at this store, blah, 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 from this farm. And actually, I've been doing that online, and if people want to check out my version, they can look for the New York City Locavores Guide. It's on localfork.com.
Okay, that's all you?
That's me.
Okay,
that's
cool.
Me. Yeah. And then the other thing is a snack. All right. The other thing is a snack, because where I will cave on my commitment to local foods is if I'm hungry and the train is late and there's that little bodega just waiting with the chips and whatnot for me. But if I've got a local snack in my bag, I'm good to go.
Those are definitely three tips. I think those are three tips for people that aren't even locavores.
That's yeah,
true. Just survival type things. And your blog. So you have a blog. You write a lot about what you're eating, about local food. Please tell the listeners your blog.
Yeah, it's Leda's Urban Homestead, and that's Leda with an E, L-E-D-A. And it's all local foods, and you can also find out about my foraging classes that are coming up. I've got a book launch event with Green Edge that the chef, Piché Ong, is actually making a special menu for.
What day is
it? On the 27th, and it's at the Village Tart in Manhattan.
Oh, okay.
And he asked for a list of my favorite seasonal local foods, and he's making up a menu based on them, which is pretty
great.
Awesome. But anyway, you can find about stuff that like that that's coming up, but it's Latest Urban Homestead.
And your first book... I mentioned the title before, but if our listeners wanted to read your first book, it's actually a memoir.
Memoir and a cookbook. Yeah.
And it is titled
Botany, Ballet, and Dinner from Scratch.
Leda, thank you for joining us on Hot Grease.
My pleasure.
Listeners, pick it up. If you're in New York City, it's the best book out there for best locavore handbook. We're going to take a short break and come back with the Hot Five.
It could be better, I guess.
It could be better. What's wrong, Ma?
I'm home alone again.
Oh, man, you all alone. Where your man at, Ma?
Well, my man, he's just always working now.
Oh, man.
It's not like it used to be.
You don't appreciate the time I put into this love affair. Oh, baby, I couldn't let you walk around thinking it's alright to let me down. I remember
the way you used to love me.
Baby, I remember.
I'm never at home anymore. He's just always working.
What do you do if you take care of business leaving you in the crib like that?
He's a cop. New York's finest, out protecting everyone but me.
Oh, man. 5-0.
Precious love and anything you wanted from me. You didn't hear me calling out, calling for your warm affection. After all this time,
you can't deny what I'm feeling.
Welcome back to Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. Hot Grease is produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Nat Wiener. This program is being sponsored by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. For more information about S. Wallace Edwards & Son, visit edwardsvaham.com. Wine, are you a novice or a semi-pro in selecting the best? No worries. April Gargiulo of Gargiulo Vineyards, located in Napa, California, is coming to the rescue. Food and Wine magazine named Gargiulo one of the 20 most notable new wineries on the planet. Welcome to Hot Grease, April.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So you're going to hit us with the Hot Five about selecting wine, correct?
That's correct. Selecting wines in restaurants and at your local bottle shop.
All right, then. Let's start with the number 5 on the Hot Five list.
Number 5, I'm going to say, is don't be afraid to choose a wine based on its label. I think a lot of people choose a wine on several other factors, but why not choose it on a label? A winery puts a lot of thought and effort into their labels, and it tends to communicate something about the wine. Beautiful labels is something that has been part of the wine industry for decades. Mouton Rothschild, one of the most famous, sought-after wines in the world for decades, has a very long history of art on their labels. Francis Bacon has done a label for them. Picasso, Dali.
Oh, wow.
Beautiful, beautiful labels.
So number four on your hot five list, and we do the hot five. The hot five is a rundown of five things on fire in the good food movement. So if you're just tuning in now, we have April Gargiulo of Gargiulo Vineyards on the phone, and she is going to continue with number four on the hot five.
Number four, and for me, I say choose a wine based on a winemaker. Find a winemaker that you like and follow that winemaker around. Winemakers tend to go from winery to winery, and or they become consultant winemakers and work on four or five different wineries, different wines. And so if you like their style, it's a good idea to sort of follow them around, find out what they're doing, find out what other projects they've got going on, and try the wines.
So are you saying that so I can look for Joe Smith and, like, follow his career, and he'll go from vineyard to different wineries?
Absolutely. For instance, Heidi Barrett, who's an incredible winemaker, incredible woman, you know, she's made some of the most sought-after, highly acclaimed wines ever produced in Napa Valley.
Wow.
And she makes wine for, I don't know, seven or eight different wineries now. She makes wines for Amuse Bouche, La Serena, her own brand, Paradigm. She started out with Bueller and sort of set the tone for their winemaking program. She's not their winemaker anymore, but, you know, find a winemaker that you love and follow that person around.
So number three on the hot five list.
You know, go to one of your restaurant, your bottle shop, ask the wine director, the sommelier, just ask them what would you drink? If you were me, what would you drink? And just blindly follow them. It's their job. They've tasted all these wines. They understand the menu. And they're gonna get to know you and your palate, and you're gonna get to know them so that you can develop a trust or, you know, never again. I would say 9 times out of 10, you're going to be positively rewarded for your adventurous spirit, and the sommelier will definitely appreciate that, you know, your show of solidarity.
Now, I don't know, speaking of restaurants and wine, I do know one spot in New York City, and we have people that are listening all over the country. You're actually in Ed's Lobster Bar.
We are, absolutely.
And I saw on the website, you are basically all over the United States. You can find Gargiulo wines.
Gargiulo, yep.
Gargiulo.
So Gargiulo Vineyards, we're Gargiulo, yep. It's a mouthful. We only produce about 4,000 cases of wine. So to say that we're everywhere is definitely not true, but we're definitely in major wine markets. So New York, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, San Francisco, you can find our wine. You know, the majority of our wine is sold directly from the winery. But we're on special lists around the country as being one of them.
Okay, cool. Thanks for clearing that up for me. I did see that you were in Atlantan Magazine, and you're in an event or had an
right.
event.
Okay. We were one of the featured vintners at the Atlanta High Auction, and which they do every year, and they choose 15 vintners to have wine dinners and be a featured vintner. So you're pouring wine, you're doing in-home private events, all for to raise money for the High Museum.
Cool. And number two on the hot five list.
Number two, unless the wine is flawed, I really firmly believe that every bottle can be a great bottle of wine when you're sharing it with friends, family, and good food. Not every bottle of wine needs to be, you know, put on an altar and prayed to. Sometimes it's just something that creates a camaraderie with you and your, you know, with your friends, your family, whoever you're sharing the experience with.
And number one on the hot five list.
You know, number one occurred to me today. I wanted just to say that smaller is bigger. And that means, to me, that means that choosing a winery who makes very limited amount of cases of wine, a small production, will yield a much bigger return. I think that you're going to get a wine that has far more expression, far more interesting, and something that will create a more lasting impression.
Great tip. So our listeners that are listening, if you don't mind giving out the website and spelling, because I basically butchered the name of the vineyard.
Don't worry about it one single bit. It is not easy. It's GargiuloVineyards.com, and Gargiulo is spelled GARGIULO Vineyards.com.
Also, Gargiulo Vineyards. It's on Facebook. You have a Facebook fan page. So if people are on Facebook,
we do.
Go ahead and become a fan. Thank you so much, April, for joining us on Hot Grease. Next time I'm in Napa, I'll have to come by and check you out.
Oh, you have to. I'd love to show you what we were up to.
Thank you. Enjoy the weather. I hope it's sunny there, but enjoy it and have a great spring.
Thank you very much. Back at you.
Thank you, listeners, for listening to Hot Grease. Join me every Monday at 3:30 on Heritage Radio Network. Until then, always take the road less traveled.